This week, we'll talk about making machine learning interpretable. And we have a very special guest today, Christoph. Christoph has a PhD in interpretable machine learning from the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich. And he worked for a while in both academia and industry, and now he is a full-time tech writer. He has written many technical books. And if you're watching this in video, there is a bookshelf behind Christoph. Yeah. With all these four books at the top, which we'll probably talk about some of them today. And yeah, it's a great pleasure to have you, Christoph. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation.
Yeah. So the questions for today, as always, are prepared by Johanna Bayer. Thanks, Johanna, for your help. And before we start with our main topic, let's talk about your background. Can you tell us about your career journey so far?
Yeah. So my background is kind of different phases. Phase one was classic statistician education, I would say, like bachelor in statistics, master in statistics. So very classic, but like hypothesis testing and stuff like this. And in the end, I was already a bit drawn to machine learning, did like Kaggle competitions and stuff. And right after I finished my master, I went to industry. So 1 year in fintech startup, where I worked as a data scientist, 2 years as more classic statistician, where I worked in medical research. And during that time, I already started writing the book, Interpretable Machine Learning, because I had like a part-time position. So next, I just had different side projects. And one of them was the book. It's a bit ironic because after my master's thesis, I really hated my master's thesis, like the writing process. So it's quite ironic that I picked up writing again then. And as I was like...
Different kind of writing, right?
It's very different, yeah. I think that was the reason why it worked for me. So when I was writing the book, I was like, it kind of took the fear out of writing for me again, because the main reason I also didn't do a PhD was like, oh, I have to write papers. I hate writing. I hated my master's thesis, so I should not do a PhD. But when I started the book, I realized I could...
You had a fear of writing, yet you thought, okay, let's write a book. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah, because, I don't know, for the master's thesis, I was very stressed out. It was not only about writing. Maybe it wasn't fear of writing, but I hated the process of it.
Experiments, all that, right? And then getting feedback from your, at least this is how it was for me. Doing all these experiments, yeah. Showing it to my supervisor, and then he would say, something doesn't seem right. Maybe you need another half a year.
Yeah. And also didn't feel so free like writing the master's thesis. But when I started the book, I wrote it in the open, got feedback, and I just could like write how I felt. So like put in some jokes and not hide behind math or anything. Just say like, oh, okay, this is like this. Use like analogies and stuff like this. So I enjoyed this part very much, which then led me to do a PhD. So back to academia. Then I again learned to hate writing. So I really hated writing papers. But still, like, I finished my PhD. This was 1 year ago. Then I actually tried like a postdoc job for a few months and another job in the industry for a few months. And it didn't feel right, kind of. I quit both very quickly. Then I thought back, like, okay, what's left? What can I do? Because I like all these things are now. I quit all these things. And so I looked back, and the only constant thing was writing for me, which I always enjoyed. And then I decided, yeah, why not do this full time? I already had my first book, so I had a little bit of income from that book and already some established like a reader base, some experience. And so I jumped into this and I'm doing this now for a year and a half now. Yeah, works out so far.
Yeah, well, I know that Munich is not the cheapest city. So apparently it's working out pretty well for you, right?
Well, I'm earning less than I did in my PhD. Uh-huh. Usually people like climb up in the career, like in the how much they earn. And for me, it was like each career step was a little less money, just a bit funny, but I have like so much freedom that I don't regret it. But when I started, I like my first job was in Switzerland. So my second job was part-time job. So I was like a little bit less, then back to Munich, a little bit less. And now with my writing again, a little bit less than a PhD. Mm-hmm. But I think full-time PhD is not. I mean, it could earn more, of course, now if I would go for a regular data scientist role. But I enjoy the freedom a lot that I have now as a writer.
So you can just go to one of the lakes in the Alps, opening the laptop.
Yeah.
Well, now maybe it's a bit cold for that now, right? But still, you can do this, right, if you wanted.
Yeah, and I can do like sports in the middle of the day or start cooking early. I love cooking, for example. But still think sometimes I'm about writing and so make progress there at the same time. So, yeah.
Do you remember what was your first Kaggle competition?
Oh, the first one. This was during my master's, and I didn't yet know much machine learning. So my first models was like a linear regression model and generalized additive model. I think it was something with diabetes. Not sure entirely what the topic was. But I remember that I was really, really bad at the competition. And this was for me also like this. Because in theory, I knew how to model data, how to build a prediction model, but just like from a statistician point of view, not from a machine learning point of view. So my first thoughts were like, okay, this should be like a generalized additive model with these features. I didn't even like have a validation set up on my side and haven't like fully understood.
That's not what you do in statistics, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I remember my first Kaggle competition was like, I did super bad. Because like I thought like with all this knowledge I have from my courses, like I would just ace it. And then the reality was the complete opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. And like, how did you become interested in interpretable machine learning? Is it something you were doing during your master's, or is it something you needed to do at your work in that fintech startup, or what led you?
I think for me it was quite natural, I think, because as a statistician, you always think about the data generating process. And when you build models, they are usually interpretable. And so this is the mindset I came from. This, okay, let's understand the data, let's build an understandable model. And when I transitioned more into machine learning, this was kind of lost. Not fully, because there were things like the random forest, which had this built-in feature importance and stuff like this. But it felt like, okay, there's parts missing. And then during my second job in Switzerland, I had these side projects, and this one day off, I read the Lime paper, which is about this interpretability method that fits like linear models to explain individual predictions of more complex models. And this was quite fascinating to me, like, oh, well, we could have a really complex model and then still have a chance to understand what's going on inside the model. And then I wanted to learn more. But I couldn't learn more because there was not so much material online. And that was my motivation to write a book about this topic. I was quite lucky with the timing as well, because there was nothing on the market yet.
Mm-hmm. So, like, speaking of Kaggle, like in Kaggle, you don't really care about the explainability, interpretability. All you care about predictions, right? You care about all these predictions, and like, it doesn't matter how exactly the model is making these predictions.
Yeah,
and like sometimes it works. At work is also like you have a similar situation, right? So like churn on churn, maybe like if it's a lot of users, you don't really go and dig deeper into each individual user when you want to understand like why this particular decision happened. Like as long as the business metrics are satisfied, like everyone is happy, like then you just, I don't know, stack more layers or I don't know, do something, right? So you don't necessarily go and try to figure out like for this particular customer why my model was wrong. I imagine there are many, many cases, especially in medical research, where you have to care about that.
Yeah. So I think I don't fully agree with the Kaggle case, because in Kaggle, of course, what gets you the money is to be right with your predictions. I think interpretability can help you even with Kaggle to debug a little. And to this really stupid example, but I'm doing a competition at the moment. And when I created the features, I kind of had a target leakage because I like a version of my target I put into my features. But I also had like interpretability at the end of the model, like to look at the feature importances using SHAP. And immediately, so first of all, I saw like, oh, the prediction errors going down by a lot. I was like super happy. But then like a little voice in my head said, this is not true. Don't be happy. There's something wrong with your model. And it turned out to be wrong. And I super quickly found the bug because for the feature importance ranking, this one feature bubbled to the top. Now, you wouldn't need feature importance for this, of course, because you could check your column names, for example. But if you have like a large feature set, then it's quite tedious to look through all of them. And for these interpretation methods, if you have such a mistake, they like target leakage. It bubbles just to top like the most important feature. And so I would say interpretability is
even on Kaggle
useful for debugging your model. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you still take part in competitions?
It's been some time, yeah. It's my first competition in many years.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's not on Kaggle, it's on, what is it called? Data-driven, I think.
Uh-huh.
It's for forecasting water volume through rivers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking of flexibility, right? So yeah. With this, I don't know if I can say the job, but with this sort of activity, you have the freedom of doing other things, like taking part in competitions. Okay. So you realized that this is an important topic. There is not so much literature, information available about that. And you thought, I don't like writing, but maybe I should try doing it one more time, right?
Kind of, yeah. So I just started. I don't know my thought process. I was just like, well, this would be a cool opportunity. And at this point, my master thesis was, I think, 2 years behind me. Maybe I just forgot how it felt. But also, it was kind of stress-free because I could just write. It was a side project for me, so no stakes involved at this point. So I had no pressure like, okay, you have to do the writing so well that you get your master's degree or to get a paper published or anything. I could just write how I felt it to be like the best way. And so this brought kind of the fun back to me for like writing stuff, because I really enjoy like understanding difficult things and writing them down in a simpler way. Writing is one way how you can express this.
Mm-hmm. So the best way is to learn something is to teach something, or at least write about this, right?
Yeah, it's a bit like this. It's also a problem because sometimes when I write my newsletter or when I pick a new book, when I already know the topic, I feel like there's not so much value in it, which is obviously wrong because at some point I didn't know these things. Like at this point in the past, I would have loved to read about them. But for me, it feels like if it's too easy to write about, it's not worth writing about it. It's obviously wrong because if enough other people have value from your writing, then your writing is valuable.
Especially if it's like an easy text.
Yeah.
Because like when it comes to machine learning, it's a complex thing. And if there is some resource that explains complex things with simple language, then it's good, right?
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, but sometimes I feel like I already understand this, I shouldn't write about it. But sometimes this is maybe the most valuable thing to write about because I already have understood it and maybe it was hard for me to understand it. But if I want to write about something new, I always feel like I also have to learn it right now. But also, one of the reasons why I became a writer was so I can always learn new things. So it's kind of like a dance between these two things. Like it should be like simple, so I can don't spend too much time on one thing. But also, I want to write about something that's exciting for me as well.
Why a book? Because like usually the story I hear from authors, and I also published. And for me, it was like first I wrote an article, then like a bunch of articles. And then I thought, okay, like maybe I do something larger.
Mm-hmm.
But you just jumped.
Yeah, that's true.
Directly into a book while not really liking writing.
Yeah, good question. For me, I already did some blogging before, but always quit after a few months. I already had a little bit of experience with writing more freely. And with the book, it wasn't like hide in my room for 2 years and then finish the book and publish it. But I published it as like a website. It's still interpretable machine learning is still available for free. And I published it like chapter by chapter. So it kind of felt like blogging. But of course, it's like a one unit. But this allowed me to get feedback very early on and to write just chapter by chapter. So it didn't feel like one huge chunk, like a huge mountain to climb, but little steps. And I think if I didn't gotten any feedback in the beginning, so I shared it on Twitter, for example, I'm not sure if I would have finished the book or if it would have just been like half a book or so, or a much shorter book.
Mm-hmm. But also, as we spoke at the beginning briefly, you don't have a publisher. You publish on your own, right?
Yes, I do. I self-publish.
And then this requires a lot of self-discipline. So like if you don't publish a chapter, in a case with a publisher, publisher would chase you like, hey, where's another chapter? Like, yeah, it's like the due date was like half a year ago. Like do something. Yeah. But here you have to be chasing, like if you're late, you have to like chase yourself. So you have to have discipline for that. See, how do you do that? Like, is there a secret or you just so like the topic and you so liked writing?
So I would say I'm inherently motivated to do the writing, but sometimes to force myself to like bring everything together because I sometimes use deadlines for myself because sometimes you feel like, okay, you could write more or maybe add another chapter, but sometimes you just have to finish and a deadline is then important. But I actually was approached by publishers, like typical technical publishers, and they asked me, for example, hey, do you want to publish interpretive machine learning with us? Or maybe also write a new book on topic XYZ. And I always like researched them, like how did they work? And then I read about it and I was like, no, that's not my style. I don't wanna have like their strict schedule. And then I heard about like, oh, sometimes the editors they have, they are not so good. And then I don't get all the like a much smaller share of the royalties. And I was like, no, I'll do this myself.
Mm-hmm. So we already spoke about the books you have on your bookshelf. Can you tell us what these books are?
So I've written 4 books. One of these is Interpretable Machine Learning, which is my first book. And there's also a second edition already. Then this is already finished during my PhD, and it's about it's basically each chapter has one method that allows you to interpret your machine learning model. And my second book, this was when I started already doing this full time, is Modeling Mindsets. It's a very small book, and it's also quite different from the first one. And it's about the different ways to think about modeling your data. I already mentioned like how I, as a statistician, participated in a Kaggle challenge and quickly realized, okay, it won't get far with the way I approach modeling. And so things like these inspired me to write this book. And my third book is quite different. It's about a conformal prediction, a method to quantify uncertainty of your models. So it's an introduction to this topic. And this was purely to, because I wanted to learn about the topic. And so I wrote the book, like an introduction book. So this was a very classic case of learning by teaching.
What's the name again?
The name of the book is Introduction to Conformal Prediction with Python.
Confounded?
Conformal.
Conformal.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever heard this term. What does it actually mean?
Conformal prediction is about the basic ideas that you have some kind of uncertainty in your model. And conformal prediction is kind of a process. So there's many different algorithms. And they conformalize this uncertainty measure so that you can kind of trust your output. So for example, you could have a classifier that outputs like class probabilities, and you could use conformal prediction to say that instead of outputting like one class or just the probabilities, that you get a set and with some guarantees. So that's the important part, these guarantees of probability, that there's like a 95% chance that the correct class is within these sets.
Hmm.
And you can use conformal prediction also for quantile regression, for example, so that the quantiles really contain 80% of your data or of your predictions, of the actual outcome.
So we spoke about this example of churn prediction. So here, instead of just saying that this John Doe will churn with probability 80%, we would have a range, an interval.
Yeah, that's also one.
Right. How certain we are that this prediction is actually correct.
Yeah, that's also one method in conformal prediction, just kind of for classification that you can put like kind of bounds on the probability that you say, okay, now you don't just give one probability, but a range between which you believe the churn prediction to be.
Is it related to, I guess there is some relationship between interpretable AI and this topic, right? Because like to come up with these bounds, you kind of need to do similar things, right? Or am I completely wrong?
So like technically, I would say it's different because let's begin with the similarities. It's a bit similar to these model agnostic interpretability techniques insofar that you can first train your model, any model really, it could be a random forest, could be a neural network, and then apply the method afterwards. Because at least for some classes of conformal prediction, which are called inductive conformal prediction, these you can apply to your model after you've trained it. And the idea is that you have like a calibration step, so you can use some output from a model which quantifies the uncertainty and kind of calibrate it the right way. Otherwise, yeah, they are quite different, I would say.
Like the methods are completely different, right? Only the way you can apply. So there is a model running in production, so you don't need to actually, you know, do anything with that model. You just do something on top.
Yeah, that's at least one possibility with inductive conformal prediction, yeah.
Interesting. And the fourth book?
Yeah, that's interpreting machine learning models with SHOP. So it has also Python examples, which my first book doesn't have about interpretable machine learning. But otherwise, it's kind of taking one of the chapters from interpretable machine learning and doing a deep dive into one of the methods, which I think is also the most popular method, SHOP, and also the one of the most versatile methods. So I decided, yeah, would be cool to have a book on it. This was one of the books where I was like, okay, I really have a lot of material already. And I still learned a ton while writing the book because you realize that you still have many gaps. But still, this was where I kind of took the stuff I already had and not only learned new things.
And how did you decide that you want to write a book about this particular method? Did you do some research that this is the most popular one? Your readers maybe ask you for more examples or more hands-on, like code examples, or like what was your process? How did you arrive at like you want to write this particular book?
Yeah, for SHOP, I already had some insights that this is hugely popular, so it was kind of a market research because I already know from my book, Interpretable Machine Learning, like Google Analytics, I know which chapters are popular, and SHOP, and this. And I also have a separate Shapley Values chapter, and they kind of belong together. They are by far the most popular ones.
They have most visits, right? Because you can see like how many times each chapter was viewed, right?
Yeah. And also, I think SHOP is not super intuitive. I mean, there's lots of material already, like blog posts and so on. But I thought that putting this all together in a book would be valuable to many readers. And then I also like find SHOP interesting because there's always this danger, like you shouldn't always only rely on one interpretation method. I also wrote like a blog post about it, like SHOP is not all you need. But if someone would force you to use only one, I would use SHOP because it's very versatile and I think there's a lot of value if you learn it.
Okay. Well, maybe we need to speak about this particular method, but I see that there are quite interesting questions. And the first question is from Rosanna. And the question is there any difference between explainable AI and interpretable AI?
Many people ask this. I don't think I have a satisfying answer. Some days ago, I posted about like an overview, how researchers use this differently. So how I use these terms is I use both interpretable machine learning and explainable AI as keywords. And I think that's most useful because there's so much overlap. People just use both quite interchangeably. And so if you want to look, like do a Google search on some topic, I would always use both. And I think I make a distinction with when I use verbs. Like when I say I want to explain a prediction, some people would criticize me now, you don't explain a prediction because it's a very strong word, obviously. But I think it's still fair to use it. And if it's so, this would be more for local, like understanding of the model. And for global understanding, I use more the word interpreting. I know that others make the difference to, or distinguish between like interpretable models. And they mean with this, like that they are kind of inherently interpretable, like a linear regression model, an explainable AI, like for these postdoc things. But I don't think that's a good distinction because it's not super clear always like the boundaries between the two. So I'm sorry, but I don't think I have a very satisfying clean separation.
So not really much difference. And like the question was about explainable AI and interpretable AI, and you corrected to interpretable machine learning, right? Interpretable.
To cover both, yeah. interpretable AI and explainable.
Yeah. Because like, this is how they usually used, or like this is how the term is? It's always interpretable ML, not interpretable.
I'm biased because I named my book this way. So in my head, it's always interpretable ML and not AI. But you can also use this. So I guess the question boils down to like definition between interpretable and explainable.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't make a big distinction between the two.
Well, if you think about the words themselves, like what's the difference between explain and interpret?
Yeah.
Interpret like you kind of interpret it and you don't necessarily explain it to others.
Yeah, for me...
I understand how it works.
Explainable for me is a very strong word. I think that was also like why I like said interpretable machine learning when I named my book. But I named it quite early on, so a lot of things happened afterwards and the term explainable AI got quite famous as well. And at some point it actually was named explainable AI, my book. Then I decided against it, and now it's interpretable machine learning. I think I like interpretability a little bit more because explainability is very strong. Because if you can explain something, you have deeply understood it.
Mm-hmm.
But interpretation is like, okay, you see something and you have an interpretation because you don't like fully understand it, but just parts and kind of derive with your like insights, which is an interpretation of what you see. So that's why I like the term more.
Okay, and now you work as a technical book writer,
yeah.
You said, for a year, right? If you've been doing this. Do you feel lonely when you just write by alone? Do you miss colleagues?
Sometimes, yes. So I like working by myself a lot. But sometimes I'm like, it would be nice to like work in a team for a day or so. The problem is you can't do this really on and off. I mean, you can, but then you're like tied to work project. And yeah, I just would like to have this like each other day, like someday. I mean, it's not fully lonely. I'm talking to you right now, for example. Mm-hmm. So you can do other things like podcasts and talk to people. Also, I'm writing a book at the moment with Timo Freisleben, who's a former colleague of mine. And so we write this book together. It's my first collaborative book. So I also have like we're a little team right now, at least for this one project. So there's mm-hmm. some, it's not only me sitting alone in my room and tinkering and writing.
I guess writing with somebody else not only makes the process kind of forces you to finish earlier, because like half of the content is written by you, half of the content is written by your co-author, and then you review each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of deliver the book faster, right? Or
I would say it's slower because my co-author, has a full-time job.
Uh-huh.
Like he's a postdoc, so he can't dedicate as much time as I could. So if I would write it alone, I think I would be faster, but it's fine the way it is, because I think it's so the topic is supervised machine learning and science. It's about how supervised machine learning is used, like for doing research and stuff. So kind of applied machine learning. And the book has two parts. It's about like justification of why it's okay to do it or whether it's okay to use machine learning. Because there's some problems, of course, with you don't fully understand the model and so on. But also like puzzle pieces that if you use machine learning in science or in research, like what do you actually need to make it work? Because if you just use it like as a Kaggle competition, then there's lots of missing pieces, like causality, interpretability, uncertainty quantification. So we're kind of putting this together. And I think it's good that we take the time to write this. So we kind of have a half draft now. But we're taking our time to really think this through because it's, I think a bit new topic and also philosophical component to it. Yeah, so I think it's a fun project.
So you said you would write it faster because like your co-author has other commitments.
Mm-hmm.
So then you also don't invest as much time as you could potentially because like you probably... So what I'm trying to say, you probably have still time, right? So are you working on something else in the meantime apart from the book?
Mm-hmm. So right now I'm participating in a challenge.
Uh-huh.
So like not on Kaggle, but another platform.
Driven Data, right? This one.
Yeah.
That you mentioned.
Yeah. And almost full time at the moment, like since a week or so. But yeah, but that's the first time I'm doing this since I'm writing. But I felt like I need hands-on project again, because sometimes can feel like this, like a disconnect if you always write about using machine learning and so on. And I do have lots of experience from earlier on, but like last 1.5 years, I've only been writing and doing no data analysis really. And then feels like a bit out of touch maybe. And so it was really good to do, or it still feels really good to do a hands-on project with all like the problems with the data and how to model it and so on.
Yeah, that's nice that you brought this up, because I used to work as a data scientist full time. Now I don't. And what I'm afraid of is like I'll lose this touch with reality, because if somebody asks me, I don't know, about something, then my answer would be based on my experience that I got at work, right? And yeah. I'm no longer working, so this answer might be outdated. And the more I know, the longer I don't work as a data scientist, the more outdated the answers, my answers become, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do I stay hands-on?
Yeah.
This is what you do, right? So you take part in competitions and you make sure that the methods you teach, the things you write about, they're still applicable, because you can try them in these real life projects, right?
Yeah, but I feel like I didn't expect this, but that the writing helps me to be better in a competition. And it's because I'm now much more structured, and I actually have like a little logbook, and I write about, okay, when I'm stuck, for example, or when I have like a breakthrough. And kind of, I didn't expect this, but it helps me a lot to like keep my thoughts in order, because in a machine learning competition, you have so many like directions that you could follow. And very often you try something and it doesn't work. And usually I still get frustrated when it happens, especially if you invest the whole day. But if you can write it down, you can process it, I think, much faster and be like, yeah, this was an experiment. Experiment showed, for example, this weather data didn't help anything with the prediction or improving the performance. So I move on to the next experiment. And like to keep myself focused on what I'm doing, it helps me so much, like that I'm more have this habit of writing. Quite unexpected.
This is so cool. Yeah. I want to learn more. Like, how do you exactly structure this? What kind of tools do you use? Like, is it just Google Doc or something?
You mean especially for this competition now? Or
yeah, for this competition in general. Like, let's say I take part in a competition and they want to follow your approach. I want to have this logbook.
Yeah.
How should I do that?
It's extremely messy. So, and I'm doing this the first time and kind of works, but it's not like I have like a fully fleshed out process how I do this.
So it's not like you finish the competition and you have a book that you can publish, right?
Yeah, I actually thought about, because there's a communication, so there's prize money involved in this project and this competition, mostly, of course, if you're like performance-based, but there's also like a competition part or like a prize part about explainability and communication.
I see why you take part in that competition.
Yeah, that was a bonus, yeah. And also the topic was interesting to me. So it's about predicting the water flow in rivers. And I like all these ecology data tasks. Yeah, so one thought that I have is that I could also use then this journey to kind of write a narrative of how I approach the entire challenge. So I try to write down every day where I work on a challenge, like a few thoughts at least.
Is it like a diary? Like, is it like a journal that each time before going to bed, you open them, right? Dear diary, today, this is what I tried.
Yeah, it's a bit like this. So I use Obsidian.
It's electronic, right? I assume, not like paper.
It's just very messy. So the idea is that it shouldn't take a lot of effort to do it. So I write very hastily, very just short sentences and bullet points. And I use it as a note-taking tool, Obsidian, so also for other things. And I just have like for this challenge, I have no one file and I just dump every thoughts in there. And also this logbook with what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but this helps me like keep focused on the project.
Mm-hmm. And I guess like these bullet points, in case you want to go back to them and turn them into a proper text, information there, right?
Yeah, one reason is that I just have this, because I wouldn't remember like, day 7, I struggled to make a good submission or whatever. And the other reason is because just writing itself, even if I don't ever look at it again, if I don't ever touch it again, it helps me to like to put into words or to summarize what I did the entire day, because it's super frustrating if you just don't think about what you did all day. But if you write it down, like two sentences, okay, today I've finished this part and I realized that using weather data doesn't help, then it's already, it helps me to keep focused on what I do the next day and to not get frustrated that maybe I didn't make as much progress, because often you do more than you think. Because you tried many things, or at least that's how I feel them.
So because I was going to ask, why would somebody even do that? Like, why would somebody even write it on day 7, I struggled to make a submission? Because like, it's not useful. But when you say that, put things in perspective, like, it's not like on day 7 you slacked and didn't do anything.
Yeah, exactly.
You actually did something, except like there were some problems. And you needed to work on solving these problems. And now you know that, okay, like, yeah, I actually worked on something.
Yeah. And
it's like to keep you motivated, right?
Yeah. And it's hard to put into words, but sometimes I struggle with something, but I don't like formulate in my head what the problem is. And then sometimes I get distracted and go to Twitter or do something else. And but writing down what, like, what's the essence of my problem, for example, in this particular challenge, the problem or the goal is to predict the volume in a season. So that's the total volume over a few months. But you have to make the predictions at different points in time. And some points or some dates are actually already within the season. So you have some partial data or some partial water flow already. And I really struggled how to put this into my model, how to like this knowledge, because obviously if you already know that some amount is already through, like has flown through the river, then you can adapt your prediction. And then this was kind of my problem I was thinking about for a few days, actually. But this helped me to put this into writing, like, hey, this is like what I have to achieve. This is the problem I have to solve, the most important one. Yeah. Almost like psychological, maybe. or like a mental process to help to focus.
Mm-hmm. How much time do you spend on this logbook? It's like 5?
Oh, very little, very little. It's, yeah. So in the beginning, I was just writing down, oh, okay, this is... So I also have like parts, okay, to understand evaluation matrix, I just like put all the information in and things like, okay, these are the data, like the problems about the data, I put have one section. So in the beginning, I spent maybe a little more, but this was like while I was reading the description of the challenge, I put in some, like I summarized the most important parts for me. There maybe, I don't know, 1 or 2 hours. And now I just like 5 or 10 minutes a day. It's very short. I just say a few lines like what I did today.
It's like diary, except it's for the competition, right?
Just for the competition, yeah.
Okay. There is a question I really like, and I think we talked about that. The question is, do you have to be an expert in the field to start writing about it?
And it helps. Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't.
I can see why it's not always...
You can make the argument both ways. So if you're not an expert, then you have the same obstacles as your future readers. That means when you write a book, you can like write about these obstacles. So these misunderstandings that you have in the beginning about the technique you're writing about or the algorithms you're writing about. But it will also be a very tough process maybe for you, because you have to learn and write at the same time.
And you also need to make sure that what you write about is actually correct, right?
Exactly, yeah. That's
like you misunderstood something, but you thought like this is the right way and you write about this, and like half a year later it turns out that it's not, and you have to redo like the whole thing.
Yeah, and it's also a question if you already know something. So let's say you would want to write a book about machine learning, but you don't have like the basics in. So for me, it would, going into machine learning, for example, was for me much easier because I studied statistics. So a lot of the math behind machine learning and working with data was already, I already knew. So you should also think about like, where do you start from? So for example, conformal prediction for me was new, the topic itself. But of course, many of the concepts I already knew, even if I didn't know conformal prediction before. So I would say the very best thing would be if you're an expert, but you still remember all your struggles.
Because you need to go down to the level of the reader, right?
Yeah.
So for you, it can be like, so for example, cross-validation for you, it's just like you wake up in the middle of the night, your eyes are blindfolded and you do cross-validation, right?
Yeah. But
for somebody who is new to that, like they might not even understand like why it's an important thing
yeah.
and how it works and why we need it.
right? And what are the gotchas?
So if you keep like a logbook when learning, then you could also remember your struggles. Yeah, so I think this would be the ideal setup, being an expert, but still remembering what it was to be a beginner.
Having a beginner who you can experiment with your things. I would say, hey, like, I don't understand this thing. You can see where they struggle, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think this is what you do with your book too. At least we talked about that for your first book, because you wrote in the open so everyone could see and comment and say where they don't understand, right? So then you could take this feedback and incorporate it into the book, right? Do you still write in the open?
So it's quite different between your books, I would say. So the first book was fully open and I wrote it chapter by chapter, and the next book were closed. So like most of the books, I guess. But I did have, so for modeling mindsets, I asked like friends and colleagues to read individual chapters. And then later on for conformal prediction book and SHAP book, I actually asked readers to be, if they want to be test readers. And this worked quite well. So this, because then I already got people from my audience.
How did you ask the readers? So you have a newsletter, right? So
yeah.
Then in the newsletter, you can write, hey, like I'm writing a book about that. Do you want to be beta users or test readers, right?
Exactly. And then people say, hey, yes. And then I kind of share a Google Drive version of the book. And then got, so far this worked really, really well. So I got extremely good feedback through this process. I'm very grateful to everyone who reads my book before they are finished. So this worked quite well for me.
Can it be problematic if you have like too much feedback, like too many people want to read your books?
I once had this problem with the SHAP book that I invited a lot of beta readers. I think one problem is, of course, if they have a very problematic part, like then all the readers will comment on this part. And then it's like also kind of a not so good that you give this version to a lot of people. So one lesson for me was to keep the list of readers not like small. And so you shouldn't have too many beta readers, I think. And rather you should have more phases where you like invite a few readers and incorporate the feedback, have a newer version, have new readers for this new version. And that's what worked best for me so far. But of course, it prolongs the process of how long it takes until you can publish.
It's also like, if you don't agree with the feedback, like what do you do?
If you don't agree, you don't have to use it. I mean, that's the nature of feedback.
But then like the person might feel offended and okay, like he doesn't want to listen to my feedback, what I'm doing here.
Didn't have this case so far. I think you should always like double check the feedback, like in the sense of like, maybe I'm wrong. So I always come from this angle, probably I'm wrong because the reader. So in the end, I'm writing for the reader.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can also have the case that this I already had, that like one reader says, hey, you should have this a simple example in the beginning. And the other reader says, hey, why is it an example already? I haven't really understood what the method is about. So this should be later in the chapter. So there can be like different tastes or different opinions also. And this, you just have to make the decision what you think is best then.
And probably like what feels more natural to you personally.
Yeah.
Let's see. Then another question I really like is, do you have any advice for somebody who is looking to start their journey as a technical author?
Yeah, don't start with a book. actually, it's what I did. But I would say start with small units. So this could be posts, like a blog post, or maybe even smaller, like on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, Mastodon, whatever, and start writing. Obviously, okay, and for posts, you can... just start writing, kind of.
Just do it.
Yeah, because I think the biggest issue is that if you write but never publish, this is frustrating. You don't get feedback. And the worst that can happen is if you publish, that nobody will read it. But that's the case if you never publish, then nobody will read it for sure. Yeah, I mean, you can do writing for yourself, but then it's more like a diary or something. But I think just getting started is the most important. It sounds so like dumb, but yeah, make it small and publish it.
Mm-hmm. But maybe also the question is like, how can I be a full-time technical author? Like, what are my steps?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't studied many people who do this full time. Actually, I think most people are just doing this like at the side. Maybe they have a successful career and they write one book or two on the side. I think technical writing is something I wouldn't recommend it. Like if you haven't done anything like this before, to just quit your job and start it, I think that's a bad idea. Because this is something you can actually like build up slowly.
Pretty much anything, right? If you haven't done something, like don't quit your job and start.
I mean, if you have enough financial security,
right,
go for it. But the thing is, if you have a job until today and tomorrow you say, okay, I start technical writing, even if you're good at it and even if you're fast, your first income will come a few months later, many months later, actually, because first you have to write the book, you have to publish it. And even after publishing it, you have to wait like 2 months before. And even if you make sales on day one, you have to wait 2 months until you get the money from the sales.
And how much time it takes to write a book?
Well, that's really difficult to say. I would say at least a few months.
1 year.
It can take many years, depending on how much time you spend with the book and how many people are involved. And like if there's a long like editorial process behind it. For me, I would say like half a year or so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So half a year of working, and then like after that, after you publish, maybe in 3 months, you'll start.
Yeah, getting... but also not full-time working, because I think you can't work full-time on a book. That's,
yeah.
I mean, I can't write 8 hours a day.
You just go crazy.
Yeah, you go crazy. Yeah. So I do a lot of other things, like now the challenge, obviously, but also like posting on social media, newsletter writing. And these are things, if you want to be self-published, and you also need some means of distribution and reaching people. Even if you're not a self-publisher, you often have to do your marketing yourself.
Yeah. So like I published a book with Manning. It took 2 years. And then it feels like, I might be wrong, but it feels like they just want me to do all the marketing.
Yeah.
Why do I need you guys? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I didn't expect in the beginning. Also, I researched this a lot. I think it might help if you have a name tag on it, like from a bigger publisher, and then it's in their library, kind of in their shop. And because of the stamp of the publisher, I think it can help, because for me, people just have to trust like in me, kind of, because there was no publisher saying, okay.
This is, you do this by already like having audience followers, right? So you... Yeah. From the beginning, you said you were writing in the open, so people could follow you and could see what you write about. But already, you already got some trust from them, right? And then by the moment you finished the book, they thought, okay, like this is such a cool book, and we know Christoph, so we want to buy from him.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this helped immensely, because I mean, I didn't have any credibility in the beginning, but I wrote the book in the open, so people just could see the book and later on decide whether they want to buy it in paperback form, for example. So there was no big trust issue or anything, because they could just read it beforehand.
And what do you use for publishing? Because like you also have physical copies. Yeah. I know that there are websites where you can sell like digital products, PDFs, videos, whatever. But like you have physical books.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, first part is where I sell is on Leanpub, which is the PDF and ebooks, and just like just a digital bookstore. Then there's print on demand services, where you basically also upload a PDF file, a cover file, and put on all the details. And then you can self publish there. So,
do they also handle the logistics?
Not at all. So,
or they send like you, they send you a truck with books.
No.
They offload it in your yard and then you do whatever you want with this.
No, that's unfortunately not the way. I mean, you could do it this way. It would be much more complicated, and I would have to do all the packaging and sending out books. Yeah. And I guess I would earn more percentage per book, but no.
But then you will not have life. We'll just do this all the time.
Yeah, I'm using Amazon KDP, but there are others as well. So that's kind of a print-on-demand service. So you upload your book there, and they sell it for you. And if you buy a book of mine, then they will just print it and send it to you. So there's no pre-printing, like, or having like my garage full of books involved.
So the book, when you do it through Amazon, the book appears in all Amazon stores, right? In the US, in Germany, like in France.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, you can actually pick like the marketplaces where you want it to appear. And you can even like pick expanded distribution, so it gets to the other bookstores as well, the bigger ones at least, like Barnes and Nobles and stuff.
Oh, okay. Like even that. So like even in people can see your books in a bookstore.
Yeah. So it's a good time to be a self-publisher because there's lots of these platforms and tools available. I actually had some doubts whether it's a smart choice because of like ChatGPT and stuff when it came out, but I'm more relaxed now. I mean, there's lots of books which are auto-generated by large language models. Yeah, but I still say that's a good time to be a writer.
Interesting. So you said that people can find your books on Leanpub and Amazon, but do you have like a homepage with all the books and links and all that?
Yeah, my christophmolinar.com/books. It's just a list of my books. Yeah.
Probably it's a good idea to follow you on LinkedIn and Twitter, right?
Yeah, it's always a good idea, of course.
Anything else you wanted to mention but we forgot to talk about?
No, just I had a lot of fun talking with you. I think it was a very nice conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, indeed, it was nice. Yeah, it's unfortunately all we have time. This is all the time we have for today.
It was very quick.
Yeah, that was quick, even though it was actually 1 hour.
Yeah, felt shorter. Yeah,
it felt like very short. Yeah, just thanks for joining us today. And thanks also everyone for joining us today for asking questions. And yeah, well, have a great week ahead and see you in a week.
You too.
Yeah, okay. Bye, everyone.
Bye.